Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Professor David Paris and Bruce Gernon next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. David, also, let me get your take on this climate gate that's been going on. What do you think's really going on?
Boy, you're really running me around here, aren't you?
I'm all over the place. I'm getting my money's worth out of you tonight.
Well, let's first... The term global warming is now taken on such a negative connotation. It's like, hey, can we let the environment do what it's supposed to do? And I make the statement like that based off the fact that if you were to look at the Vostok ice core data, and also some data that Dr. Tim Patterson up in Canada, Carleton University had come up with some core samples off of Nova Scotia. Both of these things have correlated to each other for gases that were in the atmosphere over the past 400,000 years. And interestingly enough, they begin to find that there's a relationship of the sun, a verifiable one. I don't want to, I'll use that term, irrefutable.
Mm-hmm.
That sunspots and ambient air temperature go pretty much hand in hand. And that the CO2 indicator that everybody wants to point at has an 800-year lag of being any kind of an indicator. And you got to remember is that you only have 0.03% of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's a tiny little amount in comparison to the whole of the atmosphere. 0.9% of argon. There's more argon in the atmosphere than there is, obviously, nitrogen, 78%, but 0.03%. So the whole... hot button issue here is how much do humans enter in pollution? Now, I'm not a proponent of pollution. Don't get me wrong, right? But there's a natural course of events here. And about every 100,000 years, you enter in an ice age, you come out of an ice age, you have an interwarming period like we're having right now. We're basically at the peak of this warming period, and we're going to be sliding on down on the other side and heading down towards an ice age. Now, of course, none of us in our generations are going to have to worry about that, but this is exactly what happens. It's a 100,000-year eccentricity of orbit of the Earth in around the sun, in going from kind of a circular orbit to an elliptical orbit, which gives variation of radiant energy to the Earth. You got the tilt of the Earth from 22 to 24.5 degrees. We're at 23 and 0.45 degrees right now, and we're heading down to 22, which means that we're going to have winters that are not extremely cold, but we're going to have summers that aren't extremely hot. And it means at that point, when you reach the 22 degrees of tilt of the Earth in position to the sun, it's more flat, you're going to have snow begin to accumulate up at 65 degrees north. It will begin to accumulate, and you'll begin of the beginning essence of the ice age.
Absolutely.
Push down towards past St. Louis. So if everybody start buying property along the Gulf Coast there, being the only place maybe you could live. Or you'll have people crossing the border. Instead of people coming the opposite way, you'll have people, they'll be watching people go the opposite way to avoid the ice age. But you can't stop this. It's going to happen. Now, like I said, the difference here is the models that some climatologists are using. I disagree with the fact that you use CO2 as the mainstay of your point indicator for your model. There's a thing called water vapor, and a lot of these models, they don't consider it, and that's 2 to 4% of the atmosphere. Now, water will retain heat a whole lot more in the overall aggregate of things than will CO2. And the other part of that is that methane's even a bigger menace in that respect of retaining heat. So, a lot of people have a lot of different opinions, just like I have my own opinion. But you know what? The data's staring you right in the face. The ice core records don't lie. And they tell you a story of what's going on into the world. And it will repeat and repeat, and it approximates about 100,000 years. So you got a 20,000-year point of heating up, going down, and about an 80,000-year mark for being in an ice age. And those are the facts. And I guess if I want to make that statement, as Al Gore makes, is the irrefutable facts, though are the irrefutable facts. So now I know that I've really ticked off the entire world here by...
No, you haven't, because, you know, we are believers of an Earth cycle with these weather patterns. And
yeah.
We've been pounding away at it. I had John Coleman on a couple days ago, founder of the Weather Channel and a former Good Morning America weatherman. And he was telling us this incredible story of a Roger Revelle, who was the father of global warming, who recanted later in his life and basically said, I was wrong. And let's take some calls. You both of you ready?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. We'll pick it up by going to George and Apollo, Pennsylvania. There you go. Hey, George, go ahead. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us.
Yes, Doctor, you got me excited when you said you saw these lenticular clouds in the formation there in the Bermuda Triangle. And I relate that to the Philadelphia experiment, except it's reversed. On top of the deck, they had four Tesla coils, conical Tesla coils, with a gauzing ring around the outside, and they were pulsing alternating current and had the DC. And when you said that you had the dipolar effect from the clouds going up and around,
right?
You had everything there. If you could track the mathematicians, there was three of them in the Philadelphia experiment, Tesla and Einstein. If you know the mathematics of that, you should be able to relate to this lenticular effect, which you had several of them, which would have been like the cones that were on the deck of that ship. And as you know, that transported into Norfolk for a few minutes and back. And then, of course, they got sick and they got the green clouds. So you described everything that was involved in the Philadelphia experiment, except they had it controlled. And I thought I'd pass that on to you.
All right. Let's get your take on that,
all right,
David.
Well, I haven't really spent a lot of time, you know, looking at that, quote, event. I have read some records in the context to the invisibility of the ship was more related to degaussing the ship so that it wouldn't be attractive to magnetic mines. And as far as the green fog, you're right. It's absolutely true. There was a sighting from a merchant ship of these three destroyers, which one was the Eldridge, going on trials out to sea. And there was a green fog that encapsulated those ships, and it was physically seen. I also know from some other data that I've read from Radio Monitoring Times, they did a story on this several years ago, as they looked up where the Eldridge was located all throughout the war, and they got the ship's records of the location with the convoy duties that these things were supposed to be, you know, from building the keel up. The crew was there, and their claim is that they never had this thing happen. So, is this real, or are these the real facts, or is there something else going on there? And to that, all I can tell you is what I've read. I know what we're experiencing here with Bruce's encounter and also with the electronic fog. And you're right, is that there seems to be a correlation of the two dipoles themselves and this possible pressure that creates the shrinkage of the warp field to the expansion coming back from the craft itself. Everything right at this point, we're still exploring. We don't have everything in concrete at this point. And I don't think it will, you know, it's going to flow as time goes on.
Okay. David, you had mentioned that that you'd love to get this to the FAA in terms of predictions. Would they listen to you at this point?
No. No. I mean, it would be nice, but I know of a program that's going on right now between the NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research, and the University of Wisconsin. And what they're doing is they're putting together a model that is designed to help guide pilots away from intense weather. This is something that came out in July of this year. I'm excited about it, and eventually I'm going to try to contact these guys. But, you know, am I overexuberant about their acceptance of this? It's like anything else. Until I can provide additional data, there's going to be a tremendous amount of, not invented here or go away until you got something that's really verifiable. And until you get those things down. So I'm looking at probably another couple of years at the minimum. But again, stuff like the rogue waves, I'm trying to stimulate some conversation on the scientific end here on the community to take a look at this. I mean, what is it going to cost them? You may uncover the most incredible transportation system that the Earth really desperately needs
right at this point. Absolutely. You know, it needs research, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Let's go east of the Rockies, Tallahassee, Florida. Rodial. Did I pronounce you right?
Not correctly. It's Rodial.
Rodial. All right, go ahead, sir.
Yes, greetings, George, and guest, honored guest. And I've been tuned in, turned on to Coast for, since 1994. Great program, and it's bringing so much enlightenment to the world. But my question is, what do you call these advanced beings, the Anunnakis, Elohim, the gods, the Nomos who came out of the Atlantic Oceans and taught the Dogons, the Sirius B, Sirius B star? And they thought that they were seeking gold and other precious and semi-precious minerals, and they thought it would be easier to find, sift the gold from the seabed. And do you think that they may have built an active pyramid which would power their energy systems down there? And you think, why not have any governments actively want to go down and investigate that area? Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, on the Dugans, I believe it was Sirius A, that they understood that there was a star that could not be seen unless you had the right, I believe it was a radio telescope before you could actually see this. That's what you're referring to, right?
Yeah,
that they understood this. And they were given information from, as they claim, as from alien beings that came down from the heavens. Well, the evidence certainly suggests that they didn't have access to outside books or information. And when that was disclosed to the investigator, they hadn't even seen that star system yet. So I guess it looks pretty good. Based on some of the evidence that's there, that something did occur, and they got, this particular information. Now, as far as other governments looking at power sources and that, I can't really address that. I really don't know what they're thinking about as far as whether something is worthwhile investigating or not, and I don't know how to address that.
On the government, I just did a TV show for that UFO Hunters series on the History Channel.
Good and, people. Bill Burns and company.
Yeah. Bill was quite a guy. And we went to Andros Island there where I had taken off and then flown into this strange cloud. And their theory is that AUTEC, that's an undersea research center there, combined with the RCA, that they could have something to do with some of these forces that we've experienced out there. And they wouldn't talk to the people from the crew there at all. They even kept an eye on them with their helicopters. And they've also seen some underwater USOs there. And some of the people that work there have identified them, and they were on the show, too. But there definitely are some mysterious things going on there. They had this big trench for their submarines, and they discovered this cable that led from the AUTEC base that went deep out into the tongue of the ocean. And, of course, they won't divulge, what that is. But apparently, they do a lot of research in the tongue of the ocean there, and also all around the atmosphere in that area.
David, you know, one of the theories about the Bermuda Triangle and the energy sources that are affecting these things, maybe even these electronic clouds and fog, that Atlantis was in that region and a huge crystal may have gone down with that landmass. Did you ever consider that too as a possibility, as the cause?
No, but again, I don't have any sufficient data or information on whether it existed in that area or not. I know when we flew down towards Bimini Island, I had my tri-field meter there, and I did get the meter pinned, and there wasn't any clouds around, and we were flying directly over the Bimini Road. I can't explain why the meter went off the scale.
Right, that was funny. When he was on television, he said, "Oh," and they bleeped it out.
I didn't.
We do have that capability too.
I didn't say anything bad. It wasn't what everybody thinks it was.
It was obvious you couldn't believe what your meter was doing, and it happened every time we circled over the Bimini Road for some unusual reason, that ancient structure.
Remember warp drive in Star Trek? Is that part of what we're doing?
What's that?
Is that part of this theory? Is that possible? Speed like that?
Well, here to put it in context, because, you know, whenever you start talking local space warp bubble and linear displacement, everybody's eyes start to glaze over a little bit. It's like saying calculus to my students. It's like, deer in the headlights out there, I can see it, right? All you need to do is get a piece of paper, put a dot at the top and the bottom, and then fold the paper, and you're transiting between those two points.
That's right.
That's in essence what the fabric of space. And, you know, Einstein went to great effort to and he eloquently described the fabric of space. He really got away from talking about gravity. He just basically was always relating mass and velocity. And when you start to read his actual manuscript that he has, I've got one of those here. Of course, it's translated, but I can't read German. And it might be some things into the translation, but it's very elegant. It's very succinct in the way he thought, and he thought in images. And so his pictorial descriptions just allow you to think in with this fabric of being able to compress and squeeze things and expand, but yet it doesn't just unravel space around you. You know what I mean? It's so you can have compression, you can have expansion, all in the same part, and in this case, around the local spaceport. So kind of like taking the piece of paper, folding it, transiting that, which means that you can theoretically go faster than the speed of light.
That is remarkable. Stay with us. We're going to come back with final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, Michael Shermer joins me, the skeptic. He's going to talk about consciousness and why E.T. hasn't phoned home, but through the eyes of Michael Shermer. When we come back, let's take final phone calls with our two special guests as we talk about the Bermuda Triangle on Coast to Coast AM. David, what do some of your colleagues say about your theory?
Well, they find it interesting. I think there's skepticism, as with any new theory that comes out. But you have to be tenacious about what you believe in, and you keep working towards the end, which is collect more data and verify it. That's the key in science. It's got to be verifiable, got to be able to reproduce it. So I can understand there are people who, enjoy the theory, like it, think it's exciting. And then you'll have others that, have a kind of a standoff and watch and see the approach. And that's
right.
Fine. Got to take the good with the bad. And
yeah,
it's
true.
And it's not like it's bad. It's just that's just how we are in as human beings, is we don't believe everything that we hear. We are skeptical, and that's great. And it's my responsibility to provide the data necessary to show that there is an end result and it is a verifiable theory.
Well, you know, I've got a guest on tomorrow. He's a skeptic, and I think that's healthy. I may not agree with him. He surely doesn't agree with me, but I think it's important we get those views out. Let's go to Wenatchee, Washington. Larry, west of the Rockies, you're on with us. Hey, Larry, go ahead.
Hi, George. David.
Hi.
Hi. I want to talk a little bit about Flight 19. My dad would get very upset when somebody said that the flight went down in the Bermuda Triangle, because he was on duty at Pensacola that night, and he said they never went down in the ocean. That there was radio communications, except for like atmospheres that were breaking it up that night.
Right.
But there's like from the control tower, there's an area where members of the crews that are on standby go.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a heavy bombers that were sub hunters at that time called privateers.
Right.
But so when they got an alert for some trouble, members of the crew were sent there. Anyhow, he said they were over land when they went down. Actually, their bomber went out into the area you're talking about. There was no debris. And I even asked him, I said, well, what about oil slicks? You might have mistook. And he says, no, each oil slick from a sunken vessel stuff was plotted by the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And they kept very close control over it.
What was his theory, Larry? What did he think happened?
He thinks they went into a swampy area north of there. He said, I even asked him, I said, well, yeah, but it's all dark. How they can tell? And he says, the water reflects. He says, when they lost sight of everything, it's over land. And he said, in those days, somebody might have a house out there. They might have a kerosene lantern. He says, there is no cities or lights to light things up. If they were out of the Earth's curve where they couldn't see the airfield, and they were over land, they'd get lost.
Well, there was a report from an aircraft carrier that they had heard some aircraft north of them at that point, which then kind of dispels the theory of that they crashed in the ocean, is that they actually ended up over land because their radio signals were getting stronger as they finally made the decision to start to head west versus east of the confusion factor there. So, yeah, I think your dad is 100% correct on that, on his observation. He was there, so he saw all the various pieces and parts being put together at that point.
You remember the opening of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, David and Bruce, where all these things start to appear again. You know, the boat in the desert, the thing, you know, the disappearance of planes. Have you ruled out, because, I mean, you do study UFOs too, Professor. Have you ruled out that any of these things could be taken?
No, I don't rule that out. You know, think of it this way. If we went to a planet that had life, and it could be a different form of life as we know it, you know, our curiosity to a point of, even from a scientific point of view, to take things and bring them back with you to study. I don't discount that at all as a possibility. One of the ideas about the theory about the warp is this a mechanism that craft actually use, that they've refined this to such a point that they can manipulate in our atmosphere or into space and using a controllable warp. In other words, everything is, it doesn't have to be 100% energy to create this warp to go, you know, 20 times the speed of light, but it may be able to be manipulated and to create a field such that you could fly along at 20 miles an hour. So it's a warping of a field and or shaping of the field. And this may account for why, in a number of instances of observations from people on the ground, that they see the craft there and suddenly, boom, it disappears. Or, boom, it suddenly appears. It may be all related back to a form of a space warp. Now, that's conjecture on my part. And I always like to make those statements. It's not fact, but it, based on the things that I've seen, it looks like something like that could be the factors involved in some of this propulsion that we see out there. I'm fascinated by all this. There aren't too many subjects that I'm not fascinated with.
No.
And believe me, they all tie together. All these, to look at these things as separate discipline is wrong. You got to incorporate it all together.
And back to Larry's question about being over land, I've heard that theory, and it could very well be possible. But to me, the important part of that disappearance, it was not really a space warp or anything like that, but I do believe that they were captured by this electronic fog, because it was in the same area where I went through this tunnel. They were only about 30 miles away from where the tunnel was that I went through. And I entered this tunnel at exactly 3:30 in the afternoon on December 4th, and it was December 5th, exactly 25 years earlier, when Flight 19 made their first radio call at exactly 3:30 in the afternoon, that they weren't sure of their position, and everything looked kind of white, and their compasses weren't working. So to me, I was in the exact same situation. My compass wasn't working, and I wasn't sure of my position either. So I think they were in this electronic fog just like I was.
But again, it's the situation where you can't talk to the pilots. I mean, if they would have survived, it would have been great to, you know, hear the entire detail, because I mean, we may have some clues back then to in addition to that, to 1970 is a repeatable event. And unfortunately, we don't have too many of those. Bruce's seems to be the only one. That's why we're also encouraging people from the website is to, if you've had experiences like this in aircraft or on ships, I've already had some mariners already forward some emails to me about their experience of basically transiting across the ocean from where it was supposed to take several hours that they were there in like less than 20, 30 minutes. And so can this occur onto the surface? I haven't done my investigations on that, but it appears that people have accounts of these things occurring.
Yes,
I can't verify them, though.
And you need the exact dates. If anyone can give us the exact dates, because then Professor Paris can look this up
and see what are all the context of from the weather relationship to the solar winds. And like I said, these are very unique situations that crop up. They don't happen every day. So if people have these experiences, it's very important to find out the date, the time, so we can try to correlate this. And usually what I'll do, and not usually, but I always do, is I'll build a weather forensics file that builds up all the past weather data. And you're playing detective here. And that's kind of an interesting thing, is that, you know, you're taking all this information, and you build it from the past, and you try to reconstruct what happened. It's only until recently that we really see great archival of records, you know, satellite imagery, infrared, water vapor channels, and all these things, QTs. In the past, it was kind of, I don't want to say helter-skelter, but you can't get a daily record of every satellite image that was ever taken. So things have improved. Stuff's getting better.
Okay, let's go to our first-time caller, Ernest in Houston, Texas. Go ahead, Ernest.
I don't know which subject to touch.
I know it. Good point.
I talked so much. I got predictions just about on every one of them. But if you really want to see something in the Bermuda Triangle, you need to go to the Dragon Triangle, which is located in Japan.
Right.
And if I'm not mistaken, they're supposed to be in the same vicinity as the equator. If you point them out, they come out almost identical right into. It's a possibility it could be a ice tunnel or something, or funnel to aircraft from outer space or whatever. I think you find more information out there than you would hear, because I think it was in 1986 they launched out a team of scientists on a ship from Japan. And all those scientists disappeared. The only thing that reappeared was the ship.
That was nobody, weird. With nobody on it. That is strange stuff.
Yeah. And like I said, a lot of these occurrences is not restricted to the Bermuda area. You know, there's a lot of mythology there, too, over time of things that have occurred and can't be explained. But as I'm trying to point out with the research that I'm doing here, it's not totally resident to that area. I just have access to more data there.
And yes, and there's a scientist named Ivan Lima, and he was offshore California, and he was with a group of other scientists, and they experienced an electronic fog, but it also had like a tunnel in it, and they got close to it, and they had a some sort of time lapse. And they were in a sailboat, and when they came back, nobody wanted to talk about it. All the scientists, and I mean officially, they would not talk about it because they didn't want to hurt their reputation. But this Ivan Lima became obsessed, and he started this gate project and tried to get funding so he could go back out there and capture this thing on video or whatever. And the last I heard, he was working on that project, and but now he appears to have disappeared, and no one's ever heard of him again. Huh. In case anybody knows him, I'd appreciate it if he would contact us.
Couple more moments here. Let's just take some final calls.
Sure.
Anonymous. There you go, Anonymous, wherever you may be. Go ahead.
Okay, good morning, gentlemen. I'm a retired Navy submariner, and your guest made some comments on AUTEC and the Tongue of the Ocean, and I'd like to elaborate on that, if I may. That particular part of the ocean is very unique in its characteristics. If you're familiar with the geographical layout, the Tongue of the Ocean is pretty much like a bowl that is sitting in the ocean itself. It's not as affected by the ocean currents and so forth because of the landmass surrounding it. Although there's not a lot of landmass around that area, there's just enough for a research station. And we funnel supplies back and forth to that area for the scientists that are there. So if you want to know what the cables and things that are running around the ocean in that area, we do a lot of testing down there, a lot of stuff with sonar and torpedo operations in that particular part of the ocean because of the characteristics of the ocean's water and the relative security of that area.
All right. Who wants to react to that?
What do you test there, though?
Specifically test, we look at the, if you can take a ship into that Tongue of the Ocean and listen to the noise output it makes at various depths, at different evolutions that are being conducted, we can tell, so we can repair any noise, any devices that are causing unwanted noise, emissions into the ocean, torpedo operations, a safe area to go in there and test your torpedoes, their ability to hit the target. A lot of sound trial information that's being gathered down in that area. It's just it's a really nice place to go and do things. It's not as open to the actual ocean itself. It's pretty enclosed because of the landmass around.
Okay. What do you think, guys?
All right. Very interesting stuff. Acoustics and salinity of the water, sound detection. I mean, you can build up databases with that. So if you hear that, you can the computers can then identify a particular ship and maybe even not just the class, but maybe even the actual name of the ship.
Some of the things they test there, though, are highly confidential. That's why I asked him that question just for fun to see what he would say.
Good point. Washington, D.C., Matt, go ahead. You're on with us.
Yeah, guys, so many great topics. Yeah, that's a trippy place there at the tongue of the ocean. And George, I agree with you on the whole potential for Bahamas as Atlantis theory, because there's a lot of matchups between the land masses and the other strange incidents that go on in that area. But I did want to do a quick correction. Are you guys aware that at Chichen Itza, the site of the so-called sacrifices that happened late in the Mayan civilization, sort of during the downturn, not the original period when the star pointed different constructions would be going on. That's separate from the Ekill Sacred Blue Well, which was their water source. It's a separate water table. So just a quick correction on that, because I just don't want you guys to discount what they had to say about this coming up 2012 period, George.
Okay, good.
On 5/5/2000, I was actually down there during the planetary alignment, and we had the pleasure of swimming after a sacred ceremony in the Sacred Blue Well. And I did have some pretty just over-the-top sort of prophetic, forward-looking sort of experiences there. And, all I would say on that level is that with 2012, George, I think it's a matter of, is it this or is it that? It's basically both or all. There's so many things coming to a head on spiritual and technological and danger levels for us worldwide. Nostradamus, all the Mayans, all the different Hopi in the Christian prophecies, and the rest going back to the Sumerians, point to the period as a major crossover. And with everything going on, I think just powerful times and self-fulfilling prophecy of people thinking about it or not. I think a wild ride maybe for the next 3 years, then the crossover, I don't think, is an end of the world scenario, more of a disclosure type of event. Any comment?
All right, very good. No time for a comment. We're out of time with the professor and with Bruce Gernon as well. Their websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Jesse Bowers, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.